I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. And in a moment, the Iraqi refugee crisis, a former Massachusetts state trooper, on why he feels the U.S. should help more Iraqis get out of Iraq. But first, not yet a run, but definitely a trot. Senator Barack Obama, the anti-war freshman Democrat from Illinois, says he's filing papers to form a presidential exploratory committee. He made the announcement online.
I've been struck by how hungry we all are for a different kind of politics. So I spent some time thinking about how I could best advance the cause of change and progress that we so desperately need. The decisions that have been made in Washington these past 6 years and the problems that have been ignored have put our country in a precarious place.
Joining us now from Washington, John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and Wall Street Journal columnist. And John, everyone's been anticipating it and asking him about it. But what do you make of the fact that it's happened?
Hey, it's a sensational development in this race, Robin. This is a politician who has unlimited potential. He, as was noted earlier, has got to answer questions about his level of experience and about his preparation to be commander-in-chief. But there's no doubt that this is the most charismatic figure on the American political stage at this moment. And for Democrats, that is, generally speaking, a cause for celebration, unless your name's Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Or Al Gore. I was going to ask you about that. What does this mean to their prospects, particularly Hillary Clinton's?
Well, Hillary Clinton's the front runner in the race. She still is after Barack Obama has gotten in. You can't overestimate the value of experience in the presidential process, and she's, of course, been through it with her husband, not just in the White House, but on the campaign trail for many years. She will have the ability to raise a lot of money, and she is a careful figure who does not make mistakes. On the other hand, all of a sudden, she's facing somebody who has a greater upside potential in terms of appealing broadly to the American people than she does. That's also a problem for John Edwards, who had hoped to be the not Hillary candidate in the race and jumped in early in the last week in December of hoping in hopes of slowing down Obama mania a little bit. But he may have slowed it down, but he clearly has not stopped it.
Well, put your finger on just what that is. Two best-selling books, amazing charisma when he appears before people. I'm speaking of Barack Obama. What is it?
I think it has to do with the fact that, first of all, he's somebody who reflects the totality of the American experience. As was noted a few minutes ago in your broadcast, he's the son of an African-American father, a Kenyan, a mother from Kansas. He's lived in Hawaii. He's lived in Indonesia. He is really somebody who is very much of the 21st century. And he's someone who has the capacity to make people feel hopeful and optimistic.
Well, he was also one of the only politicians to vote against the Iraq War initially, even went to a big anti-war rally in Chicago. How much does that make him leap ahead in the current climate?
I think it matters a lot, and just to be clear, he didn't vote against the war because he was not in the Senate at that time, but he articulated his opposition to the war ahead of time. Barack Obama has an advantage with the anti-war crowd within the Democratic Party. The Democratic base is extremely against this war, and there's a lot of pressure on not just Obama but also Hillary Clinton to stake out a very tough stance against the president's position. He's not done so yet, and one of the striking things about that internet video he put out is he's setting it up as sort of a process argument, saying I'm running against politics as it is, as opposed to saying I'm running to stop the Iraq war or I'm running to provide universal health care. He's going to have to flesh out his policy ideas a little bit more moving forward.
Has he taken, it sounds as if the answer is no, a stand either way on, for instance, Senator Kennedy's bill to cut off funding for new troops in Iraq?
He's not. He started out by saying that he did not think it would be wise or possible for Congress in a practical way to interfere with the president's plans. And late last week, this became a moving target, and it was clear that there was a lot of appetite within the party for a tougher stance. He said he was asking his staff to explore ways in which Democrats could confront the president, but we still don't know how he's going to come down on Kennedy's bill and others that are being proposed by various members in both the House and Senate.
So John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, columnist for Wall Street Journal, on Barack Obama's announcement today that he will set up an exploratory committee to run for president in 2008. His supporters cheering, detractors saying too early for him. And we'll just continue to watch it, John. It does get interesting. Thank you.
You bet.
Well, congressional hearings get underway today in Washington on the plight of Iraqi refugees. The UN High Commission for Refugees believes there are 1.7 million Iraqis displaced within the country. They've either fled their homes or been expelled, but they're still in Iraq. Add to that another 1.8 million Iraqis who've left the country to Syria or Jordan or farther. Today's New York Times tells the story of Iraqis who are finding refuge in Sweden, where asylum laws are looser than in most of Europe. And, of course, Iraqis are applying to come to the U.S. All told, according to the U.N., a refugee crisis. Joining us in the studio is Jerry Burke. You might remember him as the former Massachusetts State Police Major who served as a senior advisor to the Baghdad police chief, training Iraqi police officers. But, Jerry, you have a more personal story that you've been involved in statewide that brings you here today, stateside, rather, brings you here today. Your translator, tell us.
She's worked with the Americans for quite a while. In fact, her father went to school in the United States. He's a graduate of the University of Florida. And she was raised in a family where English was spoken in the house.
And so she was your translator in Baghdad.
And she, on May 16th, 2003, she showed up at the door of our hotel along with two other women to volunteer to be translators with the Americans. And she wound up being assigned to me later on, and we wound up driving all over the city of Baghdad. Sometimes I'd do the driving, sometimes we'd have police officers assigned to us, but we visited, and she was very brave to, you know, go along with us because, you know, we were targets. Mm. And we visited every police station throughout the city many times, usually right after they were attacked, mortar attacks or bombing attacks. And, you know, I'd go in to talk to the Iraqi police officers, the commander of the station, about the damage and the loss of policemen, and she'd be right there with me.
So she's an Iraqi who speaks English, whose father lived in this country, and now 3 years later in Iraq. Does she feel safe?
Not at all. There's been a number of attempts on her life and at her house at home, and en route a couple of attacks on her mother as her mother was driving around the city.
Yeah. Well, so how does it work? I mean, we know you've been, you contacted us and others to alert people that, in fact, you were working to help her get out. Does she just apply? How does it work?
Well, there's a number of different categories of visas, and she applied for one, the special immigration visa. She was working at the embassy after I left. She was working with the Regime Crimes Liaison Office. That's the group of American lawyers who work with Iraqi lawyers to prosecute Saddam and others in his administration. So she was well, you know, positioned in the embassy and working on very important issues. And I wish I could say I helped her get the visa, but she actually did the work after I left. And I found out recently that she'll be coming to the United States. And
she is one of she will consider herself lucky to come here soon. But as you well know, Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts is pushing for the U.S. to open its doors to more Iraqis. We had Ellen Saubray, Assistant Secretary of State for Refugees and Migration, on the program and, you know, questioned her about what critics say is a flawed policy right now. As you know, the U.S. had originally sent a quota of 500 for Iraqi refugees coming to this country. Legally, they can raise that. President Bush can raise it to 20,000, but apparently there's a squabble between the Bush administration and the UN as to who should oversee the refugee process. What does your friend in Iraq tell you about the need for more visas, for more people coming
here?
Well,
it's not just this one friend. There's a number of interpreters we worked with who are trying to get to the United States, and it's very difficult. First of all, they can't apply in the embassy in Baghdad. They have to go to the embassy in Amman, Jordan, to apply for the visa. And just getting out of Iraq to get to Jordan is difficult. The flights are very expensive. Royal Jordanian Airlines charges almost $1,000 for the round trip from Baghdad to Amman. It's only a one-hour flight. They want $1,000 for the round trip. If they try to drive across the border, there's a miles-long backup at the checkpoint getting into Jordan where they're checking every vehicle for explosives and weapons. So it's very difficult just to get the application filed in Amman, Jordan.
What do they have to prove that they are potential targets of violence in order to get refugee status?
No, not all the visas. There are various classifications. Mm-hmm. Maybe for the refugee status they do, but there are other classifications, like a student visa, too.
Yeah. And as you know, Jerry, there are Americans who might be concerned, well, wait a minute, who exactly is wanting to come here from Iraq? For instance, the Baathists who were deposed, who now feel that their life is threatened as well by the Shia that was formerly oppressed and now is in the majority. the irony could be that the Baathists that the U.S. went in to depose could be applying for asylum here. So do you understand why people might be worried?
Well, I understand very much why they're worried. There's a lot of refugees, and there's very little intelligence, information on who these refugees are. So they do have to be screened to find out, you know, make sure they're not Saddam's, you know, war criminals, that we're not going to have to send them back in 10 or 20 years after we find out, as we have with World War II. So I think we need to vet them. But there are some that we had one young man who was born in Baghdad, but his father was a university professor and came over to the United States to teach in Idaho. Well, this young man grew up in Idaho. He thought he was a cowboy.
What was his name?
His name was Ahmed. Uh-huh. And his father listened to one of Saddam's pleas during the 1980s for expats to return to Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War. And the father brought the family back to Baghdad. Mm-hmm. Well, this young man's brother was born in Idaho and was an American citizen and could get out of Baghdad when he reached maturity. But Ahmed was unable to. He was born in Baghdad and they wouldn't... He grew up in Idaho, thought he was an American, walked bow-legged like an American cowboy, wore cowboy boots in Baghdad.
Yeah.
He wound up translating for a program I ran for the Iraq police managers. His English was excellent. And then we wound up putting him in the Baghdad Police College. And unfortunately, one morning, en route to work, he was assassinated at a bus stop because he worked for Americans.
Yeah. Which underscores the danger that these people are now in and the need for them to get out.
Well, several of the interpreters will go through a very circuitous route. They'll take several cabs. They'll take the cab from their home to a business district. They'll watch to make sure they're not being watched. They'll take another cab to a second location. Might be three or four cab trips before they actually get to the green zone to come in to work for us.
Talk of your interpreter. By the way, what's her name?
Her name is Haima.
Who will be coming to the United States. You're in constant communication with Iraqis. What do they tell you about how many people want to flee? How many people want to flee?
Well, there's literally hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that would like to get out of Iraq, millions that would like to get out of Iraq. A lot of them would be happy just to go to other Arab countries where they have family. The Arabs are a very tribal, very family-oriented culture. Not too many of them want to just sever all ties and come to the United States alone. A lot of them want to be in other, like Syria.
So if they do want to come to the U.S., they must feel very threatened.
It's a tremendous decision. They're going to be leaving their families behind. They have to take whatever belongings they can carry will probably be all they'll be allowed to take. So it's a difficult decision to make to come to the United States, especially.
How does Haima feel about it?
Well, she seems... she's been accepted to Boston University. she's been accepted to a master's program here. Funding is going to be an issue. She's going to have to find a job and maybe some scholarship money. But she wants to continue her education and become an American. She's already talking about the 5-year wait to become a citizen.
Well, so your translator is coming, but many more Iraqis trying to get out. We want to hear their stories, and we're going to do that with Jerry Burke, the former Massachusetts state trooper. We'll do that after the break. And don't forget later, I'll look at the Libby trial with the blogger who's going to cover it. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Jerry Burke. We've been talking about Iraqi refugees as Washington takes up the topic today. And Jerry is the former Massachusetts state trooper who trained Iraqi police. And Jerry, when we first met, you told us about your experience there. There was so much hope. 3 years later, it didn't work.
No, it didn't.
Why didn't it work?
Well, I don't think we had a plan. That seemed to be the biggest problem. When we got there, there was no guidance. It was essentially, here's the Baghdad police chief. Work with him. Make your own decisions. And, you know, we'll get back to you when we get more advisors to bring in. It took them 8 months before we got our first reinforcement of advisors to work with the Baghdad Police Department. Mm-hmm. I was alone working with the Baghdad chief. But essentially, I had the Baghdad Police Department.
How many people? How many?
Well, it was supposed to be 18,000 was going to be the end strength. Oh. But, I was doing it by myself. And even then, in November of 2003, the reinforcements were 24 men. That was not much to handle a department that large.
Because I do remember the point at which one of the conversations was that this was a crisis that needed to be handled not by troops and soldiers, but by cops, you know, and you were talking about trying to get across that idea that cops on the street walking the beat were what was needed, not an imposing, troop.
Even when we got some help, we got 45 MPs were assigned to the Baghdad Police Academy. Well, you say MPs, military police, that might work, but it was a reserve unit. Only 15 of them had any substantial police experience. They were police officers in the civilian world. The other 30 were, 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks a year was the extent of their military experience. And we were lucky to get MPs. Later on, we wound up getting a hodgepodge of units assigned to us, including, artillerymen who had no police experience except maybe having been arrested by an American police officer or watching American TV shows. And we wound up having to train American civilian artillerymen on how to teach a class on police procedure.
Well, what do you think can happen now? We have 20,000, 21,000 troops going in. Again, different thing, not talking about policing. The police, in fact, became the targets of most of the violence.
Right. Every police station in Baghdad has been attacked multiple times. Several have been blown up completely, multiple casualties. I've been in stations where they've suffered 17, 20, 25 policemen killed in bombing attacks on the police stations.
Why would an Iraqi want to be a policeman at this point?
A lot of them are very committed, very dedicated, and patriotic, if you will, that they believe in Iraq. They grew up there. They're men who are in their 50s and 60s who believe and remember when Iraq had the respect of the world, when the universities in Baghdad were world-renowned.
Do you think there's any chance in the near future that right now the Bush administration is talking about troops going and being embedded with people, walking the streets, if you will, as opposed to, living in bases, almost feeling like cops. Do you think that in the near future the police will be able to stand on their own 2 feet, or is that going to be pushed aside for a while?
I think it's a long way off before it is. There's three phases or three parts to, a post-conflict or a failed state environment. And we've been doing this for a decade or more, Bosnia, Kosovo, East Timor, Haiti. It's not just military. You need the political training and you need the economic development. The political training, right now the Iraq government is very much aligned with the fundamentalists in Iran. When I was working with the Minister of Interior, there were people speaking Farsi, the Persian language, outside the minister's office. And I don't believe the government of Maliki, Prime Minister Maliki, is committed to any reconciliation yet. I think
With the Sunnis.
Mm-hmm. I think that they still live in fear that somehow the Sunnis may come back, and they want to beat down the Sunni population. If hundreds of thousands of Sunnis flee the country, that's fine with most of the Shia in the government. The middle class, they'd like to see the middle class driven out of Iraq, I believe. And they'd like to see the rest, those who remain, forced into a ghetto like the Shia had been forced into a ghetto in Saddam City, Sadr City.
Hmm. So we know about the sectarian conflict and the sectarian divisions, but it seems like you can't have a police force unless you can have those two peoples working together.
That's right. And, we're probably several years away from any sort of, truth and reconciliation like we had in South Africa.
Well, Jerry Burke, given how miserably that has failed and given that you had so much hope and promise in 2003, we've been talking about your efforts to help bring your translator here to the U.S. She is coming.
She is coming, and there's many others that I worked with that would like to come. There was one woman, I'll use the name Pearl, that a similar situation where she was born in Baghdad. Her father came to Nebraska, and she grew up in Nebraska. Her brother is named Nabras. It's a variation on the name Nebraska and a variation on an Arabic name. He later transferred to Southern California, and that's where she had her teenage years. She thinks of herself as a California, almost a valley girl or a surfer girl.
And she's in Iraq.
And she's stuck in Baghdad. Her father went back during the 1980s with the Iran-Iraq War. She couldn't get out. Her brother, who was born in Nebraska, was allowed out, but she couldn't get out.
So these are the people who want to get out, and these are the reasons why. I'm just wondering, before we let you go, just one last question. How responsible do you feel, given, and it wasn't your fault, but I'm not saying that, but given that it's been so disastrous and these people, put their lives on the line for you?
Right, and you have a sense of responsibility to some of the individuals that you worked with. But I think collectively as a nation, I think we have, you know, and I hope it doesn't get as bad as what we saw in Vietnam. We set up a situation of where we made some promises and we led the Iraqi citizens to have some expectations. And I think if I ever get a chance to write the book, it's going to be broken promises and unfulfilled expectations that, you know, we talked about establishing a democracy in Iraq, in the Middle East. And a lot of educated Iraqis came to work with us. And they bought into what we had either promised or led them to believe. And, you know, now, unfortunately, it's not going to happen, I don't think.
And many of them are in danger. Jerry Burke, former Massachusetts State Police Major who served as senior advisor to the Baghdad police chief. He helped train Iraqi police officers in 2003. And he's with us today as congressional hearings get underway in Washington about the plight of Iraqi refugees. Jerry's own interpreter will be coming to the U.S. soon. She did get a visa. And he's concerned about those left behind. Jerry, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, a quick note here. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the religious right and environmentalists come together over global warming, and also a new biography on the late singer-songwriter Nick Drake. We'll hear a lot of that music as well. That's all tomorrow. But stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Jury selection began today in one of the most high-profile Washington trials in recent memory. Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, is facing perjury and obstruction of justice charges. He's accused of lying during an investigation into who leaked the name of undercover CIA agent Valerie Plame. His trial is expected to pit White House officials against each other and feature the first ever appearance of a sitting vice president in a criminal case. The trial will also be one of the first to grant bloggers press credentials, including Rory O'Connor, a documentary filmmaker and head of the independent media company Global Vision. He joins us now. Rory, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And what exactly are prosecutors accusing Louis Libby of?
They are not accusing him of leaking the name of the CIA agent in question. They are accusing him of lying about the disclosure of that CIA officer, Valerie Plame Wilson, during the investigation into the leak. It's now been established that the former number two man at the State Department, Richard Armitage, is the person who inadvertently first leaked the name of Valerie Plame Wilson. He first mentioned that to Bob Woodward and then subsequently to Robert Novak.
And let's remind ourselves, this story all came about because former Ambassador Joseph Wilson was sent on a fact-finding mission to Africa to confirm that Iraq was trying to buy weapons-making material. Wilson, of course, was Valerie Plame's husband, she of the CIA. It was a CIA-sponsored trip. Wilson said he didn't find any proof and wrote an op-ed piece saying as much. He was angry that the White House overruled his finding and went to war. What are prosecutors saying that Libby did after Wilson's column appeared?
Well, the prosecutors in this case are saying that Libby was involved in a concerted White House effort to discredit Valerie Plame's husband, Ambassador Joseph Wilson. After, as you mentioned, Wilson had publicly accused the Bush administration of twisting information about the WMD and Iraq's nuclear weapons program. And so they're saying that Libby, at the behest of Vice President Cheney and others, attempted to smear Wilson as a result of his claims against the Bush administration that they were twisting WMD information.
Well, and this trial could represent a first. If Vice President Dick Cheney is called, it would be the first time a sitting vice president is called to testify in a criminal case. The Washington Post and others reporting that that will pit White House officials against each other. How so? What, for instance, is the evidence that Vice President Dick Cheney was at all involved in that campaign?
Well, of course, Scooter Libby was the chief of staff to the vice president, so it's generally regarded as highly unlikely that Libby would have undertaken any of the actions that he did in connection with this case without not only the knowledge, but most probably at the direction of the vice president.
Well, we are reading in reports that, in fact, people from the vice president's office will come forward saying that Louis Libby seemed to be on a campaign to, as you said, discredit the Wilson claims. How embarrassing might this testimony be for the White House at this point in time?
Well, it could be highly embarrassing, and at the very least, there's no doubt that this trial is going to be extremely uncomfortable for the Bush administration. whether or not, in the end, Mr. Libby is convicted of the perjury and obstruction of justice charges, clearly what is going to also be under investigation in this trial is the conduct of the Bush administration in prosecuting the war in Iraq.
Well, reporters are also going to take the stand, including NBC anchor Tim Russert. Why is he involved and why is he so central to the prosecution case?
Yes, it's clear that Tim Russert of NBC News is going to be a star government witness. Libby has said that he had heard this information initially from Russert. Russert, on the other hand, said that Libby had fabricated that conversation, and that, in fact, that Russert did not know anything about Valerie Plame until he read the original column by Novak saying that she worked for the CIA. So there's a clear discrepancy here between what Russert is expected to say and what Libby is saying.
That's Robert Novak, the columnist who first wrote Valerie Plame's name. Another reporter that will take the stand is Judith Miller, the New York Times reporter who was embedded early on with troops, wrote about evidence of WMD that was fed to her from her sources, and then White House operatives quoted it back from her articles as fact. How is she involved in the Valerie Plame incident?
Yes, Judith Miller, ex-New York Times reporter, is going to be a key, although probably a hostile, government witness. Miller did choose to go to jail for 85 days, rather famously, rather than reveal her conversations with Scooter Libby. Miller, of course, is saying that she had heard the name first, the name of Valerie Plame, from Libby. Libby is claiming that he has forgotten how he learned of Plame's identity in the first place, and that he therefore misspoke when he was questioned first by the FBI and later by a grand jury about his conversations with reporters. The nub of the case is that the defense is claiming that Libby simply was so busy with very important affairs of state that he had forgotten the basic facts about Valerie Plame's identity. And when he was then questioned in the course of the administration, he gave incorrect information, but that it was not on purpose, that he simply misspoke.
Well, Rory, what else do you expect to come out of this trial? How is it going to affect reporter-source relationship, for instance?
Well, I think that there's going to be a hesitation among sources as they watch this trial and watch what happens with Scooter Libby. Will they later have conversations with reporters if they think that those conversations can then be used to prosecute them? That's one of the essential questions here.
Well, and as we mentioned, this is the first high-profile trial that will have bloggers with press credentials. You're going to have one starting next week. And we understand a Wi-Fi connection has been set up in the courtroom. It's going to allow you to connect right to the Internet. So how are you going to use this? Is it sort of a play-by-play? Are you just going to be almost a stenographer during the courtroom, writing what's happening and sending it out immediately?
Well, I don't type fast enough to be a stenographer, Robin, but we will be doing what's called live blogging. And I do think that this is a significant event in terms of journalism as well. And I suspect that it's going to lead to an opening for bloggers in the future. There's no reason why journalists who are bloggers shouldn't be treated just the same as journalists who are in newspapers, radio, and so on.
Well, some would say the reason might be that you don't have the time to digest, that there's no editor involved, that it just goes right out without some sort of analysis.
Well, I don't worry about that as much as I do worry about such places as the New York Times and the Boston Globe, where they do have teams of editors, and yet we find that reporters are still making things up out of whole cloth. Robin, as you know, I've been a journalist for more than 30 years. The fact that I'm now blogging doesn't mean that I'm not a journalist suddenly. I'm simply a journalist who's blogging.
Rory O'Connor, documentary filmmaker, head of the independent media company Global Vision. To find his blog, go to our website, here-now.org. Rory, thanks so much.
Robin, it's a great pleasure.
Well, still to come today, the rich and largely unknown history of black classical music and how kids in a unique program are giving it a new voice. That's still ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. A skull that may be 40,000 years old has been found in a cave in Romania. It features features of both modern humans and early humans, Neanderthals, suggesting that the two may have interbred thousands of years ago. Now, that's news because Neanderthals were replaced by modern humans, and the question always has been, what happened? Did they merge with humans or just disappear? Well, joining us is Fred Smith, chair of the Anthropology Department at Loyola University in Chicago. Fred, we thank you so much for taking some time with us. Welcome.
It's a great pleasure, Robin.
And you have been terrific in keeping us up on this topic, including you have told me, and I'm going to switch right now, that it's Neanderthals. That's the correct pronunciation, right, because of where they were?
It is Neanderthals. Originally, it was the word is the German word for valley, and it was spelled T-H-A-L, mm-hmm. but it was always silent. So when the German spelling changed in 1901, the word for valley was T-A-L, dropping the H. But either way, whether the H is there or without it, it is always pronounced Neanderthal.
And so we are going to do as the professionals do. We'll say that. And now researchers saying that this discovered skull has the same proportions as a modern human head. It lacks the large brow ridge that we think of with Neanderthals.
Correct.
But that it also has features that are unusual in modern humans. So what do you make of this discovery?
Well, this is from a site called Oasi in Romania, and it's a very, very important discovery. The site itself is very important, because it has the earliest evidence for early modern European fossils that we have, between 35 and, as you said in your introduction, 40,000 years ago. Mm. And this particular skull is clearly an early modern human. There is no question about that. But it has a few features, prominent among that, those a little projection in the back of the skull called an occipital bun, which is a connection to Neanderthals.
And why is that important to know if they were connected? I mean, why has this question been so pressing people like you for so long?
Well, it's been pressing all the way back to the discovery of the first Neanderthal 151 years ago, and I think it has to do with our own curiosity about our ancestry. There is a tendency to think that something like a Neanderthal should not be our ancestor. It should maybe is our close cousin, but we did not descend from these organisms. And so any evidence that comes along that suggests that there is some shared biological connection here is important, because it indicates that Neanderthals did contribute at least a small amount to early modern Europeans.
Well, it also, it might be a more comforting thought than that there was a people, and you've previously told me that they're sort of like cousins to modern humans, that there was a people so much like humans that just disappeared.
Well, to some people that is uncomfortable, but in paleontology, in biology, we know that it's typical in lineages, lines of organisms, for many lines to go extinct. So it wouldn't be necessarily that unusual even for a human line to go extinct. We know further back in human evolutionary history that there were several lines of our cousins that did indeed go extinct. So it might be discomforting, but in general, that's the way that biology operates,
right.
And that's operating today as well.
Yeah. So what are you thinking, given this discovery, and there have been so many coming so quickly because of DNA work and all mm-hmm. the other modern inventions, what do you make, Professor, of this? Do you think that it means that Neanderthals and humans bred?
I do. I think it's one piece in a pie that consists of several other pieces that indicate this. Even the recent genetic work, which we talked about the last time, there is some information there that would suggest there is some connection between archaic gene pools and modern human gene pools, that not all modern human genes came out of Africa. And there's been a recent study on a very important gene that controls brain growth that also suggests that archaic people like Neanderthals are likely contributing to early modern populations. So this material from Romania, from Peșteara cu Oasi, is another important piece in the pie that suggests that.
Fred Smith of the Anthropology Department at Loyola University in Chicago. And I guess it also means no more Neanderthal jokes.
Well, you can still make the joke. We all do.
Professor Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Deep in the cavernous basement of Boston Symphony Hall, Mariana Green Hill leads three young students in a rehearsal of the last movement of William Grant Still's Danzas de Panama. The three youngsters are from Project STEP, which for 25 years has given Black and Latino kids access to classical music, providing them with instruments, lessons, and concert tickets. Mariana Green Hill is a product of the program. She went on to study at Juilliard, and now she's returned to teach.
37. And we have dum ba da dum bum bum ba da da. Can you imitate more, Danny, what Tony's doing? I think.
Tony is Tony Reimer, a 17-year-old cellist who's been in Project STEP since he was five and is on his way to the nation's most prestigious contest for young Black and Latino string players. It's next month's Sphinx competition in Detroit.
Tony is a star and was, in fact, on the way to be a soccer star. He loved soccer, and it was a really hard choice. But his love of music, I mean, he had a chance from an early age to go to professional concerts as part of this program. And he began to understand what the possibilities were. And so he put himself on a path. If you give it more shape, up and down.
That's Project STEP Artistic Director William Thomas. We sat down after rehearsal, and I asked him to characterize the goal of Project STEP. Help me with the language here. How would you characterize some of the cultural goals of the program? Because as you all know, there are Black Americans who would be sort of insulted at the notion that there needs to be a, you know, special program for people of color, and others who would say there does. So how would you...
Well, I think one of the most obvious examples would be to look at any American Symphony Orchestra and say, see, at best, maybe two or three people. In the Boston Symphony, which has been a leader in these issues, there are two African-American performers. There is clearly a professional need to have better representation.
The Boston Symphony Orchestra, I believe, is now doing colorblind screened auditions, so that eliminates some other factors that in the past, you know, racism, that might have led to less people of color in orchestras.
Mm-hmm. But, of course, our issue is to get those kids prepared to go behind that screen.
Your family's participated in classical music, I understand, for a while.
Oh, absolutely. For a number of generations, there was a church orchestra. So cousins and aunts and uncles learned to play string instruments.
You also have done research and, contrary to what some people might think, have discovered much about a rich history of African Americans in composing and participating in classical music.
Yeah, when I first started out as a student at Oberlin, I really just had no idea. Samuel Coleridge Taylor and Florence Price and hundreds and going back for centuries.
Let's talk about Samuel Coleridge Taylor, an English composer, while we listen to a little. Tell me more about, when did he compose?
He lived and towards the end of the late 19th century, early 20th century. He died very young. He had an extremely profound effect on the entire culture of Black America. Samuel Coleridge Taylor had many, many opportunities of education, and with that he wrote a work called Hiawatha's Wedding Feast, based on the Longfellow poem. It was one of the most popular pieces of classical music in the world, more popular than Messiah and more popular than the Elijah. So when he came to America, he was a hero.
I know you also wanted to talk about the artist Chevalier de St. George. A character.
Yeah, a character indeed. He was a very, very fine violinist and composer, but equally a fine swordsman. And as such, he founded a sword-fighting unit in France in the 18th century. And one of the members of that organization was the father of Alexandre Dumas. And many people don't realize that Alexandre Dumas himself was a Black man. The writer of the Three Musketeers and all of that inspires the swashbuckling was very much part of who Saint-Georges was.
This story must come in handy when you're talking with kids when you're trying to convince them to play their violin rather than soccer.
That's right, especially with bows in their hands. He was asked to be a co-leader of the what became Paris National Opera, but in fact had to stand down because some of the singers complained to Marie Antoinette that they didn't want to perform for a mulatto.
Well, I'm thinking of that especially in the context of what might be a conversation, I don't know, within the black community about classical music being, you know, white and European, mm-hmm. much as the debate over literature is today. I mean, people don't know that, you know, the Marcellus, you know, Wynton Marcellus studied at Juilliard, studied
right.
classical.
Right.
You're saying yes. I mean, so I'm wondering within that context, if there's been a rejection of classical music as white and European, is this an eye-opener?
I think that's true. It's not part of what they're learning. And, you know, there's so much to do when you start an instrument. You know, you're studying technique, you're playing in an orchestra and all of that. But the chance to understand how you belong to all of that is an important part of the training, too. Mm-hmm. And it's often neglected.
Talk about a young man like Tony Reimer. I understand he's been in the program since he was five. I mean, what does that do when you've got a kid like that other kids can look at? He's a terrific-looking guy sitting there in his Boston Red Sox T-shirt. You know, what does that do to other kids?
Yeah. Well, it's beyond measure. It just personifies everything that we are working towards to have that energy on 2 feet and being such an extraordinary example of a young man of dignity. For as an example for the young people. And at the same time, we're trying to make them understand the responsibility that they have to give back to the community, because the community has invested a lot in them. So many people support this program.
That hope that Project STEP students will advance the representation of blacks and Latinos in classical music could have been a burden, but high schooler Tony Reimer says while it's a great idea, he's not even thinking about it.
No, I just think about the music.
Even as you look around, I was struck watching you play with this quartet. That's rare, a quartet made up of all black musicians. You're not conscious of that while you're doing it?
No. It makes no difference to me whether I'm playing with a group here at Project STEP or at my school where I'm playing with a guy from California and another one from Taiwan. It's just playing music.
You sound pretty much like a high school student. You really haven't thought about these big, you know, you really haven't thought about it. You're just doing it for what? What is the pull for you?
Well, for me in music, there are two things that give me satisfaction. One is when I've been practicing a lot, playing my scales and stuff, and playing the cello just feels really good, really comfortable in my hands, and I feel like I can do whatever I want to with it. The other, musically, is when I'm playing a piece of music and I feel that the music on the page is representative of how I'm feeling, and I can basically play my feelings through my cello.
Student Tony Reimer in a practice room at Boston Symphony Hall. We also spoke with William Thomas, artistic director of Project STEP, who reminded us on this week when we celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King that King met his future wife Coretta when she was a student at the New England Conservatory, one of the sponsors of Project STEP and one of the schools Tony is considering attending. For more on Project STEP and the music you heard today, visit our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.